WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are off to the moon today, courtesy of Earl Swift, a marvelous writer with whom I've had the pleasure to speak on at least a couple of different occasions. He has given the world a marvelous array of fascinating books. I spoke with him, I think, first about a book called The Big Roads, the untold story of the engineers, visionaries, and trailblazers who created the American superhighways. I know we spoke about his book Autobiography, A Classic Car, An Outlaw Motorhead, and 57 Years of the American Dream. He has a number of other fascinating books to his credit as well. His most recent, as fascinating a book as I have read in a long, long time, which indeed does take us to the moon, and specifically explores the way in which the last astronauts on the last three Apollo flights were able to explore the moon in unprecedented fashion because of that famous lunar rover, which allowed them to travel across the surface of the moon in a way that was not possible with Apollo 11 or Apollo 12 or Apollo 14 for that matter. And that lunar rover, which in many respects is relegated to just kind of a brief footnote in the history of space exploration, is in fact a tremendous accomplishment and also one that made a dramatic difference in how important those last Apollo flights are. But just as we have largely forgotten those last Apollo flights, kind of in the shadow of Apollo 11, the first flight to actually reach the surface of the moon, so we have also neglected to understand and appreciate the importance of the lunar rover and the hardworking geniuses who brought it into being. Earl Swift has explored all of this in his absolutely marvelous book, which is published by Custom House. And I'm so excited to be able to reconnect with Earl Swift to talk with him about his book, Across the Airless Wilds, The Lunar Rover, and the Triumph of the Final Moon Landings. Earl Swift, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thanks so much for having me back.
I'm really excited to speak with you. Once again, you have found a fascinating topic and explored it with such expertise. Can you tell us how you got the idea of writing a book about something now as relatively obscure as the lunar rover?
Well, the final three missions really, I guess, attracted my attention first because I turned 13 the day that Apollo 15 touched down on the moon. And so those last three missions are really the first that I have a crystal clear recollection of. The earlier missions, I remember my parents being excited by Apollo 11 a lot more clearly than I remember anything about the occasion itself. The more I look into those three missions, the more audacious and daring and spectacular it became clear to me they were in ways that the first three, you know, we went to the moon six times. actually landed on the moon six times. Those first three missions were kind of walk-ups, literally, to what came in the last three. Exploration on a completely different scale. Science on a completely different plane. Really the last three missions brought to life all of the promise that had gone into the space program up until July of 1971.
Did anything galvanize your interest in this, or was there a particular moment when you realized there was this vast untold story about those later Apollo missions that that needed to be told? I mean, how did this initially occur to you? I mean, it's obviously escaped the notice of just about the rest of the human race.
Well, I think that the engineers who actually built the rover and put it aboard the lunar module would be pained to hear you say that, Greg.
But, fair enough.
But it's true. You know, I mean, the fact is that the, you know, I mean, we're the most automotive people on the planet. So when the rover was put aboard Apollo 15 for its first venture to the moon, you know, there was some of the press coverage was almost comical. You know, it kind of poked fun at the fact that, of course, you know, Americans would send a car into space. But the fact is that, you know, this thing had been in development in fits and starts from before this, you know, there was a space program. The first rover was envisioned by Wernher von Braun in 1952. Actually, if you go into science fiction, the first rovers were written about in 1901 before the Wright brothers even flew. So this was an idea that had been evolving, at least in nonfiction terms, throughout the 50s and 60s. And, you know, it struck me that there was a story. In the rover, you kind of see a microcosm of the whole space program. Mm. You know, you see how NASA and NASA's predecessors, how their thoughts of space exploration matured as time went on, and how it wasn't inevitable that we'd get to the moon the way we did, but, you know, given the state of technology at the time, it made the most sense that we would use the approaches we did to finally get there. And, you know, the rover story is the same. It, you know, that what seems a simple process to build a, you know, a go-kart for use on the moon was in fact a very complex process, because this was not a car. This was a spacecraft on wheels, and weird wheels.
For sure. Before we delve into the history of how this lunar rover was developed, I'd love to circle back for a moment to something that you touched on in your first remarks, and I touched on it in my introduction as well. And that is the fact that the world so vividly remembers Apollo 11, and to some extent also remembers Apollo 13, that ill-fated flight that never did make it all the way to the moon's surface because of an explosion mid-flight, but certainly we do not remember hardly at all Apollo 12 or Apollo 14 or 15 or 16 or 17. One of the things that you explore in your book, and again we've already touched on it, is the fact that those first missions to the moon, 11, 12, and 14, were vastly more limited in their scope and in what was accomplished versus what happened in these almost completely forgotten missions of Apollo 15, 16, and 17. It was the rover that made such a difference. Just remind our listeners about the limited scope of Apollo 11, 12, and 14. I mean, not that it wasn't a tremendous accomplishment to make it to the moon and back safely, but in terms of what they were able to do there at the moon, explain just how limited the accomplishment was in that respect.
You bet. You know, when Neil Armstrong stepped onto the lunar surface in July of 1969 and uttered that famous, you know, one small step for man, quote, he could not see his own feet from within his helmet. He was wearing a space suit that weighed far more than he did. That spacesuit was pumped up to the stiffness of an all-season radio, so that to move required real effort. And that effort raised his metabolic rates, which chewed through the supplies of air and cooling water in the incredibly heavy backpack he wore. So that really defines the limitation right there. The first three missions to the moon, the astronauts were on foot. They had only 2 days on the surface, and they were hamstrung by the very garment that protected them from the moon's hostile environment. And consequently, the astronauts on Apollo 11, their explorations would fit inside a football field with plenty of yardage to spare. Apollo 12 managed to probably cover about a mile and a half, a little bit less than that. But they were never, those two astronauts were never beyond sight of their lunar module. It was, they were always basically right in the vicinity of base camp. Apollo 14, Alan Shepard and Ed Mitchell went on a hike to try to find a 1,000-foot-wide crater that was only a half mile away. They became disoriented along the way. They never did get to the crater. They covered about 2 miles on that hike. But again, they were never more than a half mile from the lander. And then you come to Apollo 15 with the first rover. On its first drive, and it made three drives, it covered probably twice as much ground as all of the three previous missions combined. And all told, on its journey of 3 days on the lunar surface, covered more than 17 miles. So on the one hand, you've got the first three missions, the explorations of which all could be easily fit with plenty of elbow room into about half of the area of New York Central Park, basically into the reservoir in the middle of Central Park. And then you've got the rover missions, each of which had the potential to cover an area the size of Manhattan. It's an exponential increase in the ability to cover ground. And because of that, the missions were much more ambitious in where they put the lunar module. They put it in the middle of a varied moonscape so that by rover the astronauts could reach a lot of different types of lunar topography. And consequently, instead of the pretty featureless, flat lunar desert of Apollo's 11 and 12, you see the rovers, or you see the missions on Apollo 15, say, dropping into an area that's ringed by mountains the size of Everest, alongside a canyon that's 1,000 feet deep and a mile wide. Moonscapes without earthly equivalent. And that just fed into the much more ambitious nature of the missions on those last three.
And, of course, the history of how those rovers came to be designed and constructed is much of what your book explores, and we'll dig into some of that in a moment. Your book opens in such intriguing fashion with a trip that you made to Huntsville, Alabama, and to something called the U.S. Space and Rocket Center, and one particular building within that complex called the Davidson Center for Space Exploration. Explain what you had come to see in Huntsville, Alabama, and what it was like to lay your eyes upon it.
Well, the actual rovers that traveled on the moon are still up there. They were left behind. There was no way to get them back. They were one-shot cars. They were used for 3 days and then discarded. And you can go online now and look down on the landing sites in photos taken by the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that's still spinning around the moon today, and see photos taken in 2009 and 2011 of the Apollo landing sites. And there are the rovers, the three that we sent up. But you can eyeball the rovers that were prepared, the exact duplicates that were made for testing, the three that went up, at a number of museums around the country. And the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, which is in Huntsville because the Marshall Space Flight Center, where Wernher von Braun and his German scientists and they're American students, built the Saturn V, built the Saturn I, built the Saturn I-B, and where the rover was overseen as well. Anyway, this U.S. Space and Rocket Center is a state-run museum run by the state of Alabama, and it has one of these test models of the rover, which is as close to seeing, you know, the genuine article as you can get. And you can get closer to it, I think, in Alabama than you can. There are a couple of other test models that you can see. Johnson Space Center has one. The Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in D.C. has one as well. But in Alabama, you get to stand right next to the thing and really eye it carefully. And so I had gone to Alabama in the spring and summer of 2019. I made several trips there and found myself pulled back to the U.S. Space and Rocket Center on each visit to just stand in the presence of this pretty amazing piece of equipment. You know, on the one hand, it's a stripped-down go-kart that, you know, as essential a version of a car, is stripped down and distilled a version, as you can imagine, and it weighs less than 500 pounds. On the other hand, it's a spacecraft that happens to have wheels and you know, embodies all of the science and engineering know-how that you would expect in a spacecraft. And so it's a remarkable place to visit, and it was really kind of the starting point for my inquiry into these last three missions and what set them apart. And, of course, the answer as to what really set them apart sits right there in front of you in Huntsville. Hmm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Earl Swift and speaking with him about his latest book called Across the Airless Wilds, The Lunar Rover and the Triumph of the Final Moon Landings. This book chronicles the incredible story of the development and design of the so-called lunar rover and the rovers that went along with the astronauts to the moon on the last three missions to the moon, Apollo 15, Apollo 16, and Apollo 17. One of the things I appreciate, Mr. Swift, about your fascinating book is that although this is a book that is about a technical achievement and it's full of jargon and so on that I think you do a really, really good job of laying out for us with clarity. It's also very much a human story. This is a human triumph. And in particular, you seem to take great pleasure in drawing rich, vivid portraits of some of the central figures who are indispensable in the design of the lunar rover. And three immigrants in particular, to whom you give special and generous attention. Tell our listeners about these three brilliant immigrants who were such an important part of this story.
Well, you know, I think that in general, Greg, if you look at what helped propel NASA's effort to reach the moon ahead of the Soviet effort, it's the fact that this program drew on the know-how of a constantly replenished brain power in the form of immigrants coming to America, beginning in this case with Wernher von Braun, who is not your typical immigrant. You know, he's a Nazi, a former SS officer who made his name in Germany by building the V-2, the world's first ballistic missile, a weapon of mass destruction that was actually kind of aimed at us. But we captured him. American troops captured him after the war and decided that he was more valuable alive than standing trial for what he had done for Hitler. And so he came over with more than 100 of his German engineers, and they formed the basis not only of the space program and the Saturn rockets that propelled it, but America's early intercontinental ballistic missile arsenal as well. All of that came out of von Braun and his people. Another one of the folks that I talk about in the book is M.G. Greg Becker, who was a Polish refugee of the war, who fled all over Europe while the fighting was going on, trying to stay one step ahead of the Germans. Eventually wound up being offered a commission in the Canadian Army, and he Becker is somebody who should be a household name, and is virtually unknown outside of his field. Not nearly as romantic a figure as von Braun, but Becker invented the engineering discipline called terra mechanics, which studies the relationship between a vehicle and the ground on which it travels. And in so doing, he kind of laid the conceptual groundwork for travel on other celestial bodies. He went to work for General Motors, and there, with a third immigrant, a guy named Ferenc Pavlik, who was a Hungarian refugee at the 1956 uprising, he put together a number of early prototypes of rover vehicles that he thought could be successful on the moon and on other planets. And those prototypes evolved through the 1960s. And Pavlik, his protege, basically at GM, became the driving force behind the rover that we got. He designed the wire mesh wheels that the rover had. He put together the way that the rover could be folded to origami into a tiny tiny notch, basically, in the lunar module. But these three guys are emblematic of really something that was true of American industry in general and of NASA in particular, that foreign brain power, American brain power, but foreign-born, was key to the country's success.
One of the things I learned about Mr. von Braun that I had not known was a really important moment from early 1952. A lot of us, when we think about the onset of the space race between the United States and the Soviet Union, we think of the launching of Sputnik as being kind of the starting point of that space race. But you tell us that actually, in some respects, you could look at a issue of Collier's Magazine from March 22nd, 1952, as being perhaps the starting gun for the space race. Explain what was in this issue of Collier's Magazine and how it figures in this story that you explore in your book.
Sure. Well, Wernher von Braun was not a household name in 1952. He was completely unknown by the American public, and was asked to participate in putting together a series for the magazine on the inevitability of America's entry into space. It was 1952. We were barely in the jet age at this point, so this was pretty far-reaching stuff. And von Braun wrote several pieces for the magazine, including two that detailed how a visit to the moon would unfold. It's very different from what eventually happened, but it made him as close to a celebrity as anyone writing for a magazine can be, and eventually led to his being invited onto onto Walt Disney's Disneyland TV show, which is really what transformed him into the face of America's space effort. These stories talk about a moon mission in which the spacecraft, first of all, a moon mission would last weeks. The astronauts would land on the moon, and they'd be there for a while. And they bivouac inside almost Quonset huts that would be made out of pieces of the rocket that brought them there. And they'd eat frozen food, which, of course, didn't happen. And they would embark on these long odysseys in huge tank-like, pressurized, multi-ton rover sort of things that would need their own rockets, basically, to get to the moon. These rockets would be assembled in space. You'd launch up a bunch of little rockets carrying parts, and once in low Earth orbit, an army of astronauts floating around would assemble these rockets, and those big rockets would then get you to the moon. So that's how they envisioned it happening in 1952.
Fascinating. One of the things I appreciate about your book is that you really help us understand how our efforts to reach the moon took shape through the 1960s, particularly, of course, after President Kennedy kind of laid down that dramatic challenge of reaching the moon, setting a man safely on the surface of the moon and returning him safely before the end of that decade, a really audacious challenge, of course, in many respects. And you explore many facets of that effort that had to be in place long before Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin set foot on the moon. One of the most interesting aspects of the story that I don't remember ever hearing anything about involved a place in which I think it's in Arizona, where a landscape was, in a sense, created to try to simulate something like the surface of the moon. And you actually visited this remote location, now almost completely forgotten. Describe to our listeners what I'm talking about, what you tell us about in your book.
Sure. Well, you know, largely forgotten is the fact that in the course of their training, the astronauts visited a lot of, analogs, lunar analogs is what they were called, stand-ins for the lunar surface. And they went to volcanic fields in Iceland. They went to volcanoes in Hawaii. They traveled to the, the nuclear test sites in Nevada. But one of the most effective training places was outside of Flagstaff, Arizona, where the U.S. Geological Survey, which actually, we forget the USGS, as it was really a very important space agency during Apollo. They developed all of the procedures for sampling rocks on the lunar surface. They designed a lot of the tools that the astronauts used. Anyway, the USGS recognized that there was a need for a more exact analog for the lunar surface. So in the mid-60s, the agency used bombs made of fertilizer and TNT to blow holes in a crater or a cinder lake, which is exactly what it sounds like. There's a volcanic field north of Flagstaff at the center of which is a volcano called Sunset Crater. And in about 1079 AD, it blew its stack and rained cinders down on all of the ground around it. And near its base is this lake of cinder that's at least 50 feet deep in places. The cinder is pea-sized or smaller. And it creates this very otherworldly environment. And so by blowing craters into it, which exactly mimic a stretch of the Sea of Tranquility, which was being eyeballed for Apollo 11's landing at the time, they were able to put the astronauts in an environment that pretty closely, at least as closely as you could do on Earth, mimicked what they'd see when they stepped out of their lunar module on the moon. And you can still visit. There are two remaining crater fields in the center lake that you can still visit today, one of which is actually in pretty good shape. It's been protected very well over the years. And to stand there and imagine what happened in these places, out of the public eye mostly, is, it's one of those experiences that makes you feel pretty small and insignificant.
Right. You write, the match was uncanny. Compare photographs of the moon that the geologists used as a reference with aerials of the Arizona site, and it's striking how close the duplication came. Stand in the field's middle, and it's even more convincing. Treeless, its dark expanse interrupted only by the odd clump of chaparral, and with Sunset Crater and a cluster of cinder cones rising to the north, what came to be called Cinder Lake Crater Field Number 1 is a lonesome, otherworldly place. And, of course, you take us there in your book. We're speaking with Earl Swift about his newest book, Across the Airless Wilds, The Lunar Rover and the Triumph of the Final Lunar Moon Landings. in the 1960s, I think specifically in 1968, you tell us about dramatic budget cuts imposed by the U.S. Congress. And this, among other things, ended up scrapping what had been proposed in terms of two rocket missions to the moon. And it sounds like this had a lot to do with the sudden focus that was placed on the development of the lunar rover after a whole lot of other exciting possibilities were suddenly scrapped. Can you just give us at least a rough idea of what some of those other exciting, tantalizing possibilities were that ultimately sort of ended up on the cutting room floor thanks to these budget cuts, leaving the lunar rover as one of the sort of the last surviving ideas?
Sure. And you know, the 1952 vision that von Braun had laid out, in which rovers would be these huge tank-like things and require their own rockets to get to the moon. You know, you'd basically have a space truck, a Saturn V, that would not have astronauts aboard. It would be remotely operated, and it would go into lunar orbit, send a lander down, but on the lander would be heavy equipment, including these super-heavy rovers. That was the vision that followed all through the 60s. Even when NASA entertained the possibility that a rover might not be pressurized, but might be an open lunar jeep. The craft that they had in mind would be too big to get to the moon any other way than via the space truck, its own Saturn V. When in the fall of 1967, the budget cuts came, and it became pretty clear that there were not going to be any two Saturn V missions, and that if a rover was going to be sent to the moon, it would have to somehow fit aboard the lunar module. And NASA basically threw up its hands and walked away. I think the prevailing feeling was that there was not sufficient time left in the program to scrap everything they'd done so far and start anew on a much smaller, much more challenging kind of take on the rover. Well, those same engineers at GM I talked about earlier, namely Ferenc Pavlik, and his boss Sam Romano, and they had invested nearly a decade of work into trying to come up with rover prototypes to this point, and they weren't willing to walk away from it. And so Pavlik especially took it upon himself to try to develop an even smaller rover than this open lunar jeep that had been envisioned by NASA, and to figure out a way that it could be folded to fit aboard a very small space in the lunar module. And over the course of the 4 months, he did it. He came up with a tiny little thing, and you have to remember, this is a very small vehicle. If you were to put the rover next to a modern Mazda Miata, which is, you know, one of the smallest vehicles on the road, well, the Miata outstretches it by 2.5 feet. So we're talking about a really miniaturized, skeletonized, basically, vehicle. But Pavlik managed to figure out a way that it could be shoehorned into a wedge-shaped space on the descent stage of the lunar module, the lower half of it, a space about the size and shape of a pup tent standing on its end. You fit a whole car into that, and that made all the difference. Once he had the idea pretty well figured out, he made a scale model, 1/6 scale model of it, and he and Sam Romano took it to the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville and showed it to Wernher von Braun, and Wernher von Braun slammed his hand down on his desk and said, "We must do this."
Yeah, I think you say that, you know, some people like to think about it the moment that a toy changed history, because you know, there's a way in which this was a little toy, but it was a carefully constructed small model of what had been conceived, and just by seeing that model and the way it would fold up, suddenly what seemed fanciful instead seemed entirely possible and even utterly necessary to their efforts to get to the moon. So describe what that pattern or what that process was from that point on when we are talking about actually getting this developed and ultimately built. I mean, it's extraordinary to think about what happened in a, you know, a dramatically short amount of time.
It is. You know, from that idea, you know, from that first meeting with Von Braun, probably about a year passed before NASA requested bids for a contract on the rover. It took that long to work its way up the chain and to get everybody on board. And so in July of 1969, just as Apollo 11 was landing, the bid, you know, the request for bids went out. So we're talking right there, you know, at that point, July of 1969, the end of Apollo is already visible on the horizon. So they knew they had very little time. They let the contract, Boeing and GM won the contract working in partnership. And they got it around Halloween of 1969, which gave them 17 months to put together not only the rope, not only to construct the rover, but also design and test it. And NASA equipment typically took at least twice that length of time. And so it was a frantic, hell for leather dash to get this thing built. And it's one thing to, you know, to propose a rover and to have a 1/6 scale model and to have most of the particulars worked out. It's another thing to build it in such a way that it can survive the rigors of space, you know, just the rigors of launch. It was a very difficult process. And at times seemed almost sure to fail. It seemed that they would never make their deadline. And they did blow their budget by a factor of two. But you know, they managed to scramble it, get it together, and actually the first rover was delivered to NASA 2 weeks early.
You tell us that this accomplishment was a wondrous meld of engineering and imagination. And at one point you describe it as a feat of less is more engineering that was radical even by NASA standards. Help us understand that less is more notion of how this had to be designed and what a challenge that was.
Well, because it had to weigh next to nothing. And the reason is that any additional weight on the lunar module cut into its ability to hover for any amount of time. Apollo 11, as it came in for a landing, hovered for a lot longer than anyone expected as Neil Armstrong looked for a safe place to land. And consequently, it had only a few seconds of fuel left when it did touch down. So that was very much in NASA's mind. The conventional wisdom at NASA was that every 10 pounds of weight you add to the lunar module, you know, eats up 1 second of hover. So that when NASA gave the green light to the rover, the paramount objective was to save weight. You can't have this thing weigh a tenth of an ounce. It can't be a gram more than necessary. So consequently, the rover was designed only to work in 1/6 gravity, which enabled it to be of much lighter construction than an Earth car would have been. So, for instance, the floorboards that supported the seats that the astronauts sat on, the floorboards were of aluminum alloy 1/50th of an inch thick. Now, you have to hunt around for a wood veneer that's thinner than that. This thing would snap instantly under an astronaut's weight on Earth. But in 1/6 gravity, yeah, it worked. Same thing with the seats. The seats, they look like beach chairs. They were of they were nylon webbing. In the case of the rover's beach chairs, they were also, they were fireproof and they could withstand a bombardment from meteorites. But they looked like beach chairs and they weighed next to nothing. And that's the reason they also could fold, which was important. The rover's motors, they had an electric motor in each wheel and each generated only a quarter horsepower. But they were mated to transmissions, a bizarre transmission called a harmonic drive that has only three parts and only two of them move. But that transmission translated that that dribble of power into enough torque to move the rover along at a maximum of 8 to 10 miles per hour. But, you know, it was capable of going straight up the sides of mountains. It was a distillation of a car, but it was a very capable machine, and it could only operate on the moon. That was one of the compromises. It had to be so wispily constructed that it would never work on Earth.
Right, and of course, they didn't construct it on the moon. They couldn't test it on the moon. They had to try to simulate those conditions to the best of their ability right here on Earth. And that they succeeded to the extent they did is truly amazing. And indeed, your book then chronicles just how successful the rover ended up being, a very successful element in these last three missions, Apollo 15, 16, and 17, working remarkably well. I do have to make sure you tell our listeners about the replacement fender that was necessary during, I think it was Apollo 17, the very last time that men were on the surface of the moon.
It was Apollo 17, and the lunar surface is a powdery, it's a dark, very powdery, very fine-grained dust for the first several inches. And it's both fine enough that if it gets on your clothes, it'll smear. But it's also really gritty. It kind of has a corrosive effect on any moving part that it comes in contact with. So one of the, the prime directives of rover design was you've got to keep dust away from the moving parts of this thing. You have to seal its moving parts, protect them from dust. You have to prevent dust from getting on the vehicle at all, because this, although the moon looks light-colored to us up in the sky, the dust is actually close to black. It's a charcoal gray. And it absorbs heat from the sun. So if it gets on any electronics, it can overheat the machine and render it useless. So it was really important they kept it dust-free. And so the rover had these fiberglass fenders that, covered their entire wheels pretty much. On two of the missions, on 16, late on Apollo 16, and very early on Apollo 17, one of the extensions that enabled this full coverage snapped off of a back wheel. Same back wheel in both cases. It was the passenger side rear wheel. And in the case of 17 had a very ambitious menu of things that its astronauts had to accomplish that involved driving a great distance. They covered 22 miles in the course of their mission. And having a rooster tail of dust thrown onto the astronauts and the electronics while they did it was just a non-starter. It just, they had to find a fix for this broken fender. And with the help of Houston, with astronauts and engineers working down on the Earth, they managed to construct a replacement fender made of four USGS contour maps of the lunar surface and duct tape and two clamps. That were used to affix lamps to the inside of the lunar module. And it wasn't pretty, but it got the job done.
Right, and we can see a photograph in your book that shows us their handiwork that did indeed get the job done. And, of course, that's the story here of getting the job done, even when the job is something as extraordinary as traveling on the surface of the moon. And as I said, your book gives us in fascinating detail exactly what occurred on those last three Apollo missions, Apollo 15, 16, and 17. A last question. You were able to speak with some of the people who were very much hands-on participants in the design and construction of these lunar rovers. In some ways, I think you probably feel like your timing was impeccable, because had you waited even 10 years, probably some of these voices would have not been available to you. Just give our listeners some sense of some of the extraordinary people you were able to speak with and how important a part they are in you being able to tell this story as well as you do.
Well, I was lucky enough to speak with Frank Pavlich, the Ferenc Pavlich, the Hungarian refugee who really, if you were to pick one guy who is the most responsible for the Werber that we remember from Apollo, it's Frank Pavlich. And I got to visit him for a couple of days at his home in Santa Barbara back in 2019. I've spent a lot of time with Sonny Morea, who was NASA's head man on the job. He was the director of the Werber project for the Marshall Space Flight Center. I got to talk to astronauts like Charlie Duke, who was on Apollo 16, and part of the pair of astronauts who on the moon I think had the most fun, and who just enjoyed hot rodding around in the rover more than anybody else. So it's the time, I was very lucky in the timing in two respects. One, it was very surprising how many of the principals in the story were alive and well, and also and this is blind luck, I did all of my reporting, my in-person reporting, just before COVID, and so I was able to meet a lot of these people face to face, and visit the sites, like that Crater Field in Flagstaff, before travel became really difficult to pull off.
Well, it is an extraordinary achievement, and it says a lot about how meticulous you were in doing this, that there is a full 5 pages of acknowledgments in which you thank a number of the people that you just detailed and many more beyond that who helped make this really incredible and fascinating book possible. And I, again, appreciate so much the fact that you explore a lot of technical matters in a way that does not leave us bewildered and in the dust, but you really help us understand all of this really well. At one point, you write in the acknowledgments, to write about this tiny sliver of Apollo required grounding in a host of unexpected topics, and the more I learned, the more remained for me to know. That's exactly how I feel as I finish reading your book, Across the Airless Wilds, The Lunar Rover and the Triumph of the Final Moon Landings, published by Custom House, the author Earl Swift. Earl Swift, congratulations on bringing the world yet another endlessly fascinating book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. What a pleasure to speak with you again.
Greg, thank you so much. A million thanks. It's a pleasure.
Tomorrow on the morning show, several different interviews, including one with Alex Metalski and a couple of his colleagues who are busy with final preparations for a production of Shakespeare's Oedipus Rex, which is going to be performed in the Lincoln Park Floral Gardens beginning this coming weekend. On Wednesday's morning show, a conversation with Ariel Sabar, the author of a book called Veritas, which examines a really intriguing case of deceit at the highest levels of academia, in which a Harvard professor and a leading authority on ancient biblical documents was taken in by something of a scam and came to erroneously believe that a recently discovered fragment of parchment was from a gospel written by the wife of Jesus. a really extraordinary and entirely true story called Veritas. We'll hear that on Wednesday's morning show. On Thursday, J.B. McKinnon's book, The Day the World Stopped Shopping, which examines the possibility of what the world would be like and our lives would be like if we suddenly stopped shopping so much, if we turned our back on the rampant materialism and consumerism.